Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio program. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. The reason for a live program is so that you can call in and talk to the host in real time. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith that you don't know where to go to ask someone, you might ask here. You should never consider that the answer you receive here is the final answer on every subject. You may want to let this be your first or second opinion about something that you receive. We will do our best to answer biblical questions with biblical responses. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. This Saturday night, there is a meeting in Buena Park in Orange County, California. If you're in L.A. County, Riverside County, Orange County, this may interest you. We are going through the books of Nahum and Nahum and Habakkuk. Yeah, we're going through two books. They're short, very very short books, but we're going through the minor prophets each month. And these two come up this month. That's tomorrow night. And if you'd like to join us, I'd love to meet you if I haven't before, and I'd love to have you join us. The location can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under announcements. Now, the location is The Way Fellowship in Buena Park, but if you don't know where that is, there's a map and there's instruction. There's all the information you need at thenarrowpath.com under announcements. That's tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. All right, we're going to go directly to the phone lines and talk to these callers who are lined up here. One of them is Teo from Tampa, Florida. Hey, Teo, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
First of all, I want to thank you for your book, Empire of the Risen Sun. That was one of the most insightful reads I've had in a while. And I read through the first one, I think almost twice, and I'm well into the second one right now, book two right now.
Great.
So thank you for that.
I'm glad it's helped.
Yeah. Yes. Very good. But let me get to my questions, because I always seem to have a number of questions for you, but let me try to get to it right away. I guess the most interesting one to me was I've been reading a lot of the Old Testament lately, and I noticed that again and again in the prophets, God says he's going to, sinful people or evil people are going to die, or they ought to die, or they're worthy of death. And I guess I was just curious, what was the thoughts of the Israelites on the alternative? Because it seems that everyone dies sooner or later in this lifetime. So what did they think happened to the righteous after death?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's the question of what happens after death that was the issue. In Israel, in the Old Testament, the law promised long life and good prosperity and good health and things like that to those who were obedient to God. There is no actual promise in the Old Testament of heaven or hell. There's not much discussion about those things, but people would prefer under that mentality to live longer. Obviously, most people prefer to live longer anyway, if they believe in heaven and hell. So that to say that he's bringing judgment upon Israel or upon some other nation and they're going to die, was suggesting they're going to die like soon. They're going to die prematurely.
Okay.
They'll die under this judgment as opposed to living on. As far as what they may have thought about the afterlife. Yeah, exactly. As far as what they knew about the afterlife, we really don't know, because the Bible in the Old Testament doesn't talk about the afterlife. But that doesn't mean they didn't have any expectations about it. I think almost every thinking person realizes there must be something after this life. I mean, it doesn't make sense for something as much in the image of God as human beings are to simply live a brief lifetime and then disappear, and everything that they've accomplished is lost or whatever. So, people usually have theories about the afterlife, but we don't have any real revelations about it, given in the law or in the prophets.
Okay. And I do have one more question. It's in 1 Peter 3:19, where it says, Christ preached to spirits in prison. And what do you know what that means?
Well, there's several theories, but I think I know what it means. At least I know what I think it means. Let's put it that way. I believe that Peter is saying that the people that Christ preached to on the occasion he's referring to are now dead and their spirits are in prison. They were not in prison when Jesus preached to them. They were alive, and they were preached to by Noah through the Spirit of Christ. Notice he says, through the Spirit, Jesus preached to the spirits in prison. And which ones? Which ones is he talking about? Well, the ones that were disobedient in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared. So he's not talking about any large, you know, sweeping group of people throughout Old Testament history or anything like that, but rather just the people that while Noah was preaching, Noah was building the ark, he was apparently preaching. And Peter's suggesting he was preaching through the Spirit of Christ to those people who were disobedient while he was building the ark, so that those people now are dead and their souls, their spirits are in prison, he's saying. But they weren't at the time. It's just that what he's saying is that the Spirit that spoke through Noah is the Spirit of Christ, and therefore Christ through his Spirit preached him. Now, earlier in the same book, 1 Peter chapter 1, and I guess it must be around verse 10 or so, it says that the prophets of the Old Testament also spoke by the Spirit of Christ. So what Peter is saying is that Christ has spoken to people even before he was born on earth through his Spirit, through the prophets and through Noah and so forth.
Okay, I think I can understand that. Okay, well, thank you very much. I do have more questions, but I want to give others the opportunity as well.
I appreciate that. We'll hear from you again. Okay, we'll hear from you again. God bless you. Okay, Jennifer from Brighton, Colorado. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Jennifer?
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say that your Bible ministry has been a blessing to me. Currently, I am studying Revelation, and I am using your Four Views book as it's a great tool during this study. So my question I've recently been loving to read out of the New Living Translation. What are your thoughts on that version of the Bible? What do you think is the most accurate English version out there? And I guess also too, what do you prefer? What version do you usually prefer to do your study out of when you're doing like an in-depth Bible study?
Right. Well, when I'm doing an in-depth Bible study, I don't trust any translation completely. There are some translations that I trust to be more word for word accurate than others, because there are some translations whose translators aimed at being word for word, and others where the translators did not. The New King James is one that I use. The New American Standard version, I've also said, is a good version. There are a number of other versions that aim roughly at a word-for-word translation. I think the ESV aims at that. I'm not sure how many others do, but most modern translations do not aim at a word-for-word translation. They aim at trying to capture the thought of the original and rephrasing it into our language, trying to give the same thought. Of course, we call that paraphrasing. Now, some versions, you know, are so paraphristic, like the Message, for example. If you read the Message, a lot of people like it, but I don't know why. There's not many times, if you read a verse or two in the Message, you won't find one word in the English that corresponds with any of the words in the Greek or the Hebrew. In other words, it's not a word-for-word translation. It's an attempt to paraphrase ideas into, you know, the translator's own ideas, as he would say them. And I don't like that kind of a translation. The New Living Translation is a little bit that way, not so much though. The New Living Translation is governed a little more by what the text actually says, but it is still not word for word. It still aims at being a little bit more of a paraphrase. But what I usually suggest is that if you find you know, that your Bible reading is not always very in depth, and you're just kind of reading through the Bible to get the idea of what's in there, then the New Living Translation or the NIV would be among those that people find helpful, and that's fine. But if you're going to study the Bible, I wouldn't use either of those. I suggest that you do both, that you read the Bible in a translation that you find easy, but that you also have a translation that is more literal. Now, what you can do, and what I do, yes, which one I would use in my study, I would use an interlinear version. You can get the Greek-English interlinear New Testament and the Hebrew-English interlinear Old Testament. And this has actually the actual words of the Hebrew and the Greek text with actual English corresponding words over each word. So you know you're getting a word-for-word translation. Now, it's a little harder to read. You're not going to use that probably for your regular reading because the word order in the Greek or Hebrew is not going to be the same as the word order in English. And in particular, the Hebrew, you're going to have to read it backwards because the Hebrew reads from right to left instead of from left to right. So it's not going to be the easiest thing in the world to just use an interlinear as your Bible for general reading. But if you're going to study a passage and you're going to study a subject in depth, and you really want to know what the words of the Bible say on the verses that you think are relevant to your subject, you're going to want to get something, at least a word-for-word translation as best you can, but better still an interlinear English and Greek, or interlinear English and Hebrew, depending on if you're using the New Testament or the Old. Of course, I would have both. All right, I appreciate your call. Frank from New York City, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, thank you very much. God bless you.
Uh-huh, God bless you.
I'd like to touch on a couple of subjects that I've heard during this past week that are fallacious, Steve, and if I have the time, I would try to touch on them all, but you could correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was yesterday you made a statement that was to the effect of, you said, if a person is living for Christ day to day or moment by moment, that is not a legal fiction. Well, you're right about that. But the problem with that statement was the Catholic Church actually used that term, legal fiction, not in the way you used it. You misappropriated it. They were talking about the fictitious notion of Protestant justification at the time of the Reformation, and which is, they deemed it was juridical, forensic. It was a declared righteousness. It changed the person's status before God, but not his nature. And that cannot possibly be. That's what they called the legal fiction. You have to be born again, regenerated, in order to have your sins forgiven. But they changed the definition of justification from what it was for 1,500 years and separated it from regeneration. That's the first problem. The second problem, you also said something like Abraham believed the Lord and it was deemed to him as righteousness, right? I think you said right. Cited in Genesis 15, 15:6.
Yeah, and Paul and James both quote that too, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have to look at what the Lord said about that. What did the Lord mean by Abraham believed the Lord and it was reckoned to him as righteousness? If you turn to Genesis chapter 26, especially verse 5, Abraham's dead. He's talking to his son Isaac, and he tells them basically the same thing he told Abraham. I'll make you as the stars of the sea and the stars of the sky, sands of the sea. And he says, like your father Abraham, who walked in my commandments and kept my statutes and ordinances. Mm-hmm. That's what faith was to God. It wasn't faith alone. Faith alone is fictitious. That was made up by the whole cloth by Luther. And that's how we got that legal fiction, as I mentioned before.
Okay, well, Frank, it sounds like you haven't said anything different than what I said on the subject.
That's fine.
Yeah, where did you think we disagreed?
The way you use legal fiction, you misappropriated it to a man who was trying to live for Christ. That's not what the church meant by that.
I meant it just the same way you're talking about. That, you know, justification by faith isn't where God takes somebody who's an unrepentant, man living in sin and just says, oh, you're okay now. But that would be a legal fiction, that if God legally said, okay, he's innocent, but there's no in no sense is he innocent. I mean, when God forgives, he declares us innocent. He gives us amnesty to start over again. But that amnesty then repositions us into a position of subjection to him as our king. So that, of course,
right.
we actually live, what I was pointing out is that we actually live a righteous life. And we don't only, you know, it's not like we're not merely declared righteous. God does declare us righteous in the sense that he cancels the past. He expunges our record, our rap sheet, you know, and says, okay, since you've repented, I'm going to trust you to do better this time, and I call you clean. That's how I understand. I think you do, too, so I don't think we disagree. Scott from Phoenix, Arizona, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Uh-oh. No Scott? Going once? Going twice? Hey, I hear something there. Scott, are you there? Guess not. Okay, he's not there. Let's go ahead and talk to Michael in Watsonville, California. Hi, Michael. Good to hear from you.
Hey, Steve. Good to hear you.
Yeah. What's up?
So, we're watching this gentleman, Marshall Davis, and he is a Christian pastor, Protestant pastor. I think he's retired from actively preaching, but he was doing that for many years. Now he's making videos, and he's attempting to bridge the gap between the different traditions, which I really appreciate. And I know that you, as an evangelical believer, would not accept his his bridge gapping, as it were. But, you know, I think, you know, I mean, I love the Spirit of Christ, as you know, and I go on to church and Bible study. And for me, it's an experience. It brings me into my heart. It helps to do that. And I think the difference that I've always had with you in the evangelical tradition in general is not so much of a... it's like I'm not saying that there's... And Buddhists don't deny a divine reality. They're not secular, sort of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, anti-theist. It's not like that. It's just...
Yes, I understand.
The difference is more of an epistemological in the way that the divine is known. And so...
So what is your question, Michael?
So the question would be, would you acknowledge that the concept of God is different from the experience of the divine?
Well, it can be. I mean, there's no reason that it should be. That is to say, if I experience God, I hope it's the God that I can justify conceptually as the true God. Now, as a Buddhist yourself, you feel that you have some experience of the divine, and you say you love the Spirit of Christ and things like that,
right.
But you don't conceptualize a personal God at all. You don't
right.
see a creator God. Now,
right.
Now, see, I don't know what you're experiencing because I'm not you. I know that what I experience when I experience the divine, it is agreeable with the concept that Jesus taught about God. And the Bible teaches about God, how God revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your ancestors, by the way. And, you know, God revealed himself to them, and I agree with them in their understanding of him. They experienced God, too, by the way. And there's no reason why a person's experience of God should be contrary to their concept of God. Now, your concept of God is apparently contrary to what your experience is, because you would say that you experience the divine, but you don't necessarily believe there's a personal God. So you may be experiencing some kind of a spiritual spirituality. That's and maybe there's in some sense some connection there with the divine, but you haven't yet known him. You know, Jesus said to the Samaritans, to the Samaritan woman, he says, "You Samaritans, you worship, but you don't know what it is you're worshiping." And he said, we Jews, we do understand. We do know who we're worshiping. Now, I suppose he's saying that the Samaritans, they too were worshiping God experientially, as the Jews were. But the mm-hmm. Samaritans didn't know who God was, so their concept of God did not align with their experience as, say, Jesus's did and some of the devout Jews. So I'm not sure why a person would want to have an experience with a God that doesn't agree with their conception of God. Now, your conception of God may be that there is a vague sort of divine essence out there or something like that, and that you've connected with it. Now, the Christian view of God is that there's only really one God. He definitely is the personal God. He's the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ. But that there are other spirits, not just God. God is a spirit, Jesus said. And angels are spirits, but there are other spirits. And of course, we believe there's demonic spirits. We believe there's a devil. And we do believe also that this devil has one thing that is his main priority, and that is to deceive the world, the Bible says. He is the father of lies, Jesus said. Now, the devil has powers to set up spiritual counterfeits so that people are deceived into thinking that what they're experiencing is God, but it may not be. And especially if they are, let's say, in denial about God, who he is. For example, if he is a personal being like Jesus said he is, and somebody is in denial about that, says, no, I believe there's a God, but he's not a personal being, like, he's not a father like Jesus talked about. Well, then that person, of course, is saying they know more about God than Jesus did. And a person's entitled to say that if they want to. But I can't imagine what would make them think they did know more about God than Jesus did. And, you know, why wouldn't somebody just go with what Jesus said on this if they want to experience the God that Jesus revealed? I mean, you love the Spirit of Jesus. Well, the Spirit of Jesus bears witness to Jesus, bears witness to the fatherhood of God, too. So, you know, I think what you're saying, you love the feelings you get when you're around Christian worship and things like that. And you've told me that before, but you know you like the vibes of Christianity, and yet you don't really like the truths of Christianity, which is kind of a I don't know, a strange position to stay in for very long.
Steve, can I respond?
Uh huh.
So no. My point is more. What you're saying is my main point today is more basic than that, and it's simply the difference between the concept of something and the reality. I mean, you don't believe that God is a old man with a beard sitting on a throne in heaven, right? Most Christians probably don't believe that. That's an idea. That's a conceptual image that people have.
And right, but what is your main point then? If it's not what I said, it's not, the question you asked me is there a difference between one's experience of God and their concept of God? And that's the question I was addressing. What is your question if it's not that?
It just seems this is just for me. Okay, I'm not criticizing, judging anybody else. This is just for me. This is why I dropped out of Hebrew school when I was before I would have been bar mitzvah. That any image, it just seems that whether it's an old man with a beard, or I don't know how people conceive of God, but it would just be a conception in my mind. The reality, anything that I could think about that would only be an image that I would carry. So I don't feel to have an image.
That's why it's so necessary to make sure that we're not thinking thoughts about God that are contrary to the way he revealed himself, either in through the prophets or through Jesus, either one. Now, your understanding, would your understanding of God be somehow associated with Dharma?
Well, my understanding is that I can't conceive of things that are not perceivable.
Right. Now, what is your conception? What is your conception of Dharma as a Buddhist?
Well, my disposition toward it is, it is whatever it is. Whatever I think about it may reflect the reality of it, but it's not anything. The intelligence that is sort of governing the functioning of the universe and karma and all that. I can't see that. That's invisible.
Well, right, and God is that way too. I mean, Jesus said God is a spirit. Okay, so you know, here's the thing, Michael. The only thing I think you are open to the idea of there being a divine mind or a divine will. I mean, Dharma, you know, who orders the karmic circumstances that will come to each person in the next incarnation, seems to have a will. You know, seems to have a moral concern. So, the view of God that the Christian has is that this mind, this will, is actually has personal love also for the creation. And it seems like adding that part is the part that you have the hardest time dealing with. I'm not sure why, because it seems like that would be not a very large step from, I think, belief in Dharma itself. But Dharma is not God, of course. At least Christians don't believe Dharma is God. But I think that's what you in Buddhism would have as a substitute for God. And I say, why settle for that when there's a real God who revealed himself through Jesus? Anyway, I've got to take a break. I appreciate your call, Michael. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. If you want to know how to help us out, you can go to our website where there's lots of free resources. It's thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour. And now it's going to be another half hour. We've got a half hour behind us. But every day we're live for an hour on weekdays so that people can call in like those we're doing on the first half of the program, and which you can do in the second half of the program. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you have a disagreement with the host, you're welcome to call me. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And I want to make this announcement one more time because it's my last chance before tomorrow. Tomorrow night in Southern California, Orange County to be precise, I have a meeting that occurs only once every month. If you happen to be in Orange County or near, I'm in Riverside County, so that's not really in Orange County. We have people who do come from L.A. County, so you don't have to be in Orange County. But if you're interested in that meeting, tomorrow night at 6 in Buena Park, California, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under announcements and see where that meeting is and when, and we'd be glad to have you join us. That's tomorrow night at 6 in the evening. All right, let's talk to Rick from Napa, California. Hi, Rick. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Hi.
Thank you. You know, you've mentioned marriage issues a couple times, and I've been driving today. I'm off, so I wanted to make a comment, and that is that the impression that I get from in Matthew 19 from what Jesus said about marriage is that it's permanent.
Yeah, that's what it's supposed to be. Yeah, that's how God made it.
And then, you know, going to 1 Corinthians 7, it would seem that for Christians, the bondage that they're under is if Christians separate, God expects them to reconcile, to settle the issue. Yeah. But if the unbeliever departs, then you're not under bondage to reunite. You're free from the responsibility to reunite. But the idea that that means you're free to remarry would seem to me to be an assumption rather than what the text clearly says.
Actually, I think the text is relatively clear because it says if a Christian, let's say it says if a wife has left her husband, let her be reconciled with her husband or remain unmarried. So she's not required to reconcile. She could remain unmarried. And that's what you're saying is the distinctive of a Christian whose unbelieving spouse has left, that they don't have to reunite, but they have to remain unmarried. Well, that doesn't differ at all than what he said to Christians married to Christians either, because in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, he recites what Jesus said. That is, he says, this is what the Lord taught. And it obviously refers to Christians married to Christians. But then in verse 12, he says, to the rest, and the rest, of course, are those who are married to non-Christians. He said, the Lord didn't speak anything of this. I will. But what he did say to the Christians married to Christians, don't depart. But if they do depart, remain unmarried or be reconciled. You see, if someone has been departed from their spouse, it may not be possible to be reconciled because their spouse might not take them back or their spouse might have remarried. So, in other words, the person who is separated and is receiving this letter, and they're a Christian who is married to a Christian, and if they've departed from the marriage, they should go back. But it may not be possible if their spouse won't take them back, and therefore they should remain unmarried. Now, then Paul gives different instructions to Christians married to non-Christians. And among the things he says is that if this unbeliever departs, you're not under bondage. Now, you're saying not under bondage means you're not required to take them back, or not required to pursue reconciliation, but that you must remain single. Well, I don't think that differs. I don't think that differs from the instructions he gave to Christians. So if you are bound to your marriage, then you can't remarry. If you're not bound to a marriage, then you can remarry, because if you're not bound to a marriage, you're not in a covenant. What makes remarriage adultery, in the cases where it is in fact adultery, is the fact that there's a covenant in force. Your first marriage is still in force. And if you marry somebody else, you're breaking that covenant. But if you, as I think you believe, no matter what happens, you're still bound by that covenant, well, then you would have to seek reconciliation, because in your covenant vow, you promised to be joined together. And Jesus said, what God has joined, don't let man put asunder. Now, notice Jesus forbade man to put it asunder. He didn't say it can't be done. Anyone who wants to know if a marriage can be broken up doesn't have to look very far to see that it can be. It's what Jesus forbids to do. But what puts a marriage asunder is adultery. Adultery puts it asunder, and that's what Jesus, I think, teaches in the Sermon on the Mount, even in Matthew 19, which you mentioned. Matthew 19, 9, he says, if any man divorces his wife for any cause other than fornication, then he and marries another, he commits adultery. So the problem here is if he's committing adultery in his second marriage, it's because his first marriage was not terminated. He's not legitimately terminated. He's still married as far as God is concerned. He may have gotten a court-sanctioned divorce, but if there was no grounds for divorce as far as God is concerned, that man is still bound to his covenant, and he cannot remarry without committing adultery. But you're certainly, every person is entitled to read the Bible and come up with their own best understanding of it, and that's what you've done. I appreciate you sharing that. I always do say I'm eager to hear from people who have seen things differently than I do. By the way, I don't know if you've read my article on divorce and remarriage, but I've written a lengthy article that's at our website, and I think it covers all the verses and exegetes them very responsibly, including the one you brought up. So maybe you haven't read it, or maybe you read it and were unpersuaded, but I would recommend, if you have not, that you go to thenarrowpath.com and look under the tab that says Topical Articles. And there's one there that's called Divorce and Remarriage. And I believe that I leave no stone unturned in terms of biblical evidences and opinions about that. But anyway, thank you for joining us today. Scott from Phoenix is back. Hi, Scott. Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I got a question, if I could, maybe a comment afterwards. But would it be all right if... I haven't been going to church for a couple of years because I think it changed, but would it be right if I went and just a fellowship, and when like the pastor or whoever got up to give their sermon, if I left, would that be all right?
Well, I mean, why would you do that?
Well, I find the places that I had gone before the pastors are very dispensational and very Calvinist. And in every sermon, they weave that in there. They weave those things in there. One actually says, we believe he's talking like us as a congregation. We believe like 7 years is whatever, you know.
Okay. Well, let me just say, if the pastor's always saying things and emphasizing things in his sermons that you don't agree with, then I would suggest that's probably not the best church for you to be in. But it certainly would not be. You're in Phoenix, Arizona. It's one of the largest cities, out west here. And there's lots of churches. I'm sure you could find a church that the pastor doesn't emphasize or even believe in dispensationalism or Calvinism. If you could find, for example, a Church of God with their headquarters in Anderson, Indiana. Church of God, Anderson, Indiana is there one out there in Phoenix area? I don't know. There might not be. It's a pretty small denomination, but where I've been, I've enjoyed visiting them because they're not dispensational, they're not Calvinistic. Church of Christ is that way too, but some Church of Christ fellowships are somewhat legalistic, but not all. Not all the ones I've met are, and they are not dispensational. They're not Calvinist. So if you look around, you'll find either a church that doesn't hold those views that you object to, or maybe they hold them and don't mention them much. Frankly, you have to be willing to fellowship with people who don't hold your views. I certainly am happy to fellowship with Calvinists and dispensationalists, though I don't hold either of their views. But I wouldn't have any reason to sit through sermons of a pastor who was always talking about those things. I mean, what's the point of sitting there and just being, disagreeing all through the whole sermon? Obviously, I understand. But I don't know, Scott, if you've really done sufficient shopping for a fellowship in your area, because there certainly are plenty of them that don't teach those doctrines or don't emphasize them, though I'm sure you'll find plenty of them that do. Now, as far as is it a sin not to go to church if you can't find a good church? If you were in Pakistan or if you're in Saudi Arabia or in Turkey and you couldn't find another Christian anywhere and you didn't go to church for that reason, I'd understand that because you can't find a church. But if you're in Phoenix, Arizona, and there's millions of Christians there in hundreds of churches, I'm not saying you have to visit all hundreds of churches, but you shouldn't have to visit very many before you find one that isn't saying objectionable things every Sunday in a sermon. You need fellowship. And I know you mentioned, is it okay if you go for fellowship but not for the sermon? Well, you could. I mean, you could. But most of the fellowship in a given church is surrounding the pastor's message. I mean, everything's leading up to that. And afterwards, sometimes, if you go to midweek services, sometimes they're based on the pastor's message. Obviously, if the message is a bad message, then you should find a different church. That is, if the message is consistently bad. I mean, I can go to a church and hear a bad message and not decide that I'm never going to go there again. But if I go, as you say, every Sunday, and every time they do, they're talking non-biblically, then I would find another church. And if I couldn't find one at all, I guess I'd start looking for some friends in my area who are like-minded that we could get together and fellowship with. All right. By the way, also, Methodist churches, Nazarene churches, Wesleyan-type churches, they are not Calvinistic. And some of them are not dispensational, though some of them would be. All right, let's talk to Ken from Winters, California. Ken, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
I know you used to be a dispensationalist, and you're not anymore.
Right.
But listening to you over the years, I've kind of on the fence now. I was wondering what passages in the Bible actually led you to give up your belief in dispensationalism.
Well, I'm going to have to recommend that you go to my lecture series. I'll give you an answer, but it's a long. The answer is really much longer than what I can give you with this many people waiting behind you in a short radio show. But if you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under topical lectures, there's a series there called When Shall These Things Be? Now, that compares the dispensational view with the amillennial view for the most part. And I start out by pointing out why I was a dispensationalist, what things happened to chip away, what scriptures really bothered me in terms of chipping away my dispensational convictions, and how I came to be believe what I do now. And there's lots of scriptures involved in that process, so I can't give them all to you now. But I will say what happened first was it became clear to me at one point that the Bible doesn't mention anywhere a pre-tribulation rapture. Now, a pre-tribulation rapture is one of the main distinctives of dispensationalism. There are others, but that's one of the main ones. And I had never heard the word dispensationalism, though my teaching I had received was dispensational, and the teaching I was giving others was dispensational. I didn't know the word dispensational. But the pre-trib rapture is one of the distinctives of that. So when I discovered that the Bible didn't teach that anywhere and seemed to teach the opposite, namely that, as Jesus said, he's going to raise his people up on the last day, and as Paul said that, you know, the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout and the voice of the archangel and the trump of God, and the dead in Christ will rise, then the living will rise. This, he says, is at the coming of the Lord, not 7 years before, not even 3.5 years before. It's not any time before. It's the last day, Jesus said. So, as I began to realize that there was not one verse in the Bible that said one thing about a pre-tribulation rapture, but there were verses that simply were not consistent with it, that's the first thing I gave up. Eventually, I gave up other aspects of dispensationalism, but I didn't know the system. I didn't know it was called dispensationalism. I taught it, but my views on Israel had to change, because dispensationalism is that system which indicates that God is primarily working with the nation Israel in end times. And again, I had to study my Bible out and find out that that wasn't really true, not in the Bible anyway, and so forth. So, I mean, it took a lot of different steps. It took me years, actually. I was still essentially a dispensationalist for years as I was evolving, as I studied my Bible and giving up one after another of the dispensational views without knowing they were part of that system. It was only after I had totally abandoned the whole system without knowing about it that I found out that what I had abandoned was called dispensationalism. That's the fact. And it was even longer before I knew that what I had come to was called amillennialism. So, but this took years, and that's why it'd be such a long story. If you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, under topical lectures, look up the series, When Shall These Things Be?, and you'll get a very thorough answer, much more than I can give here. I appreciate your call, though. Thanks for joining us. All right, let's talk to Anonymous from, it's not Anonymous, it's Grace from Burleson, Texas. Hi, Grace. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thank you for the ministry that you're all over a blessing. Can you hear me okay?
Thank you.
Okay. My question is kind of similar to one of the previous callers, only I am mostly shut in from disability, from chronic illness, and I'm having a hard time with finding a spiritual support system. I don't have, like, internet and all the technology to do that. And I was wondering if you might have any ideas as to, I could really use, like, a prayer partner. Mm-hmm. Do Christian, mostly Christian radio. That's where I'm at. They don't have Christian television other than like CBN and the 700 Club. And then on Sundays, they do have some on Sunday morning. And so I was wondering if you had any ideas as far as how I can connect with the spiritual support system and even like a prayer partner.
Did you say that you're a shut-in?
Yes, sir.
And you can't get out. Okay. Do you know any Christians? Do you have any...
No, I was born and raised Roman Catholic, and my family is mostly still Roman Catholic. Then I'm in another state because I came down to Texas for the medical treatment because of my health and disabilities. So I'm in, you know, a different state, and then also don't have, like, my, you know, family in this area, immediate or extended or friends or that kind of stuff. But then they're not born again either.
Okay, well, why don't you... look in the phone book or get online if you have a computer and look up the churches in your area and call some of them and say, tell them exactly what you told me. Say, I'm a shut-in. I'm looking for someone who can pray with me. I'm looking for someone who can fellowship with me. Is there anyone in your church that does that? Almost certainly. You won't make more than two or three calls, I wouldn't think, before they say, we have a pastor who comes out and visits like that. Or we have some... people who do that kind of thing. And you see, they could answer your question more than I could, because I don't know anything about what's available in Texas myself. But if I were in a situation like yours, in any particular location, I would look for local evangelical churches, and just say, hey, just tell them what you told me, and I'll bet you won't have to make very many calls before someone will say, yeah, we'll visit you, and you might find a good spiritual support group there.
Okay, I hope so, because I have tried that in other cities and didn't find it there, but maybe
really?
In Burlington I might find that here.
Well, you're in Texas now.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping.
All right.
And then also, I know that your question and answer program, but can I just put that out there that I could use prayer
for my
health and healing,
yes.
And then also just for spiritual support system and provision, strength and perseverance to keep standing with all the chronic disabilities that I have. And then they just diagnosed me with another disease.
So, oh, my. Well, I'll tell you what, yes, you absolutely may. And, in fact, I'll just do that right now. Anyone out there, we've got thousands of people listening. Just remember Grace in Burleson, Texas. And, Grace, do you have email?
I don't right now. I'm trying to get set up with that.
I see. Because if you did, I would ask for you could send me your email address, and others might seek to contact you that way. So anyway, but you might as well just reach out to the local Christians, the ones in your town, are the best ones to be reaching out to first. And yes, I'm going to encourage our listeners to be praying for you that you'll find.
Thank you so much. And then when I get set up with email, I will give you a call back.
Okay, Grace. Thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless you and have a great day.
Same to you. God bless you. All right. Dana from Mount Lake Terrace, Washington. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Oh, I'm so glad I could take your call. I mean, you took my call.
Sure.
Yes, I've read both your books, and I just think they're wonderful. Every
Thank
Christian
you.
Should read them. But I've been reading it through my scriptures, and I come to the book of 2 Samuel, and I wonder if you could give me some insight on chapter 21 about there was a famine, and David inquired of the Lord what to do about this. And the Lord said that because Saul was bloodthirsty, he killed the Gibeonites. Now, it says who the Gibeonites were, and then David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you, and how can I make this atonement, because Saul had killed some of them or something. Anyway, to make a long story short, what they said, they wanted the king to deliver seven of Saul's descendants to be hanged, and so it says here in verse that the Lord said he and those I will give them. But in verse 7, the king spared Mephibosheth, because the son of Jonathan, he was the son of Saul, was the one that David and Saul had this commitment that he would honor him, you
right.
know. But then verse 8 says the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth and two sons of these others and so forth, and the five sons of Michael, and then he delivered them, and they killed them, and they all got hung. I felt so sad when I read this, but it sounds like he took Mephibosheth anyway. Is that true, or am I reading this wrong?
No, that was that he took another Mephibosheth, Armoni and Mephibosheth. Yeah, there were two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul. So this was not Saul's grandson, Mephibosheth, whom David spared. This was one of Saul's sons named Mephibosheth.
Oh, yeah,
so,
I see.
So I
misread that. So this
right. So Jonathan's son Mephibosheth had an uncle also named Mephibosheth, who was a half brother of Jonathan, and that's who was taken. So it was a different Mephibosheth.
Okay. Well, I didn't know. I thought that was confusing. Because
yeah.
sometimes you read
in
the scriptures and people have the same names, or they maybe have a different name.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have
very
two
common.
Names. But anyway. Well,
yeah, very commonly. There's a lot of people with the same name in the Bible. Like there's like 30-something Zechariahs in the Bible. There's a lot of people who have the same name. But in this case, it mentions in verse 7 that David wanted to spare Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. But then it says he delivered Mephibosheth and Armoni, the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bore to Saul. So these were sons of Saul.
I didn't see. I didn't know who Jonathan's wife's name was, so that's why it's confusing.
Right,
I thought maybe he was married to this daughter of I owe something, but I didn't understand. So this is a different one. So that really cleared that up for me, because I was confusing. I thought sometimes,
all right.
Everything the Bible contradicts itself, but it doesn't. It really doesn't. But it sounds like
it doesn't. In fact, it's interesting. Some of the verses that people claim are cases of the Bible contradicting itself are verses where the writer would have to have lost his mind after writing one verse, because the very next verse is the place where they think they find the contradiction. Like when Paul says that everyone must bear his own burden, and then a couple of verses later in Galatians 6, he says, bear one another's burdens. Or when Paul says, I'm not yet perfect, but a couple of verses later in 1 Corinthians, he says, let those of us who are perfect think this. Actually, it's not 1 Corinthians, it's Philippians. But, there's times when we need to really read the context carefully, or else it's confusing. And when we get confused, it sometimes looks like the Bible contradicts itself where it actually doesn't. All right, I appreciate your call. I hope that's helpful to you. Richard from Moreno Valley, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, because I know we're short on time, I just was informed that an old friend of mine, Monica Morales Chavez, has just been diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and I'd like some of your listeners to pray for her. She's going through a lot of suffering and a lot of pain, and other friends are telling me it's kind of getting bad. But
would you like to pray for her right now?
And yes,
people
I
can
would.
Agree with you? Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Father, Lord, I just pray that you hear our prayers, Father, and you give this young woman, she's not so young, but she's as old as I am. I'm just turning 61 tomorrow. Anyway, did you just, give her comfort, Father? I know she is in a lot of pain, Father, and you help her family and just to be with her, comfort her. You help her friends to come to comfort her and just do what they feel that they can do for her, Father. I pray this all in your son's name. Amen.
Amen. Did you have another question? We have maybe a minute or two.
Yes, sir. I used to live in the Santa Cruz area, and I've been searching for God for a while, and I came across lots of different believers and went to a lot of churches that I didn't really feel comfortable with, but I had heard of you, and you were having a lecture in Santa Cruz on Portola, somewhere between 36 and 41st Street at a church. Anyway, I saw you, met you, and your lectures that night was awesome. What I was asking about is I'm searching, and I met some people that were awesome in the San Francisco Church of Christ. I met a guy, and he led me to a pastor whose name Russ Yule, and he was led by another pastor.
Okay, I need to break in here because I'm out of time. They're going to cut me off here in about 30 seconds. But I'm glad you found some good fellowship. I'm sorry we didn't get through that quicker so we could have heard what you wanted to say. But again, I'm going to be cut off here in just a few seconds. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are listener-supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. You can donate from there, but everything there is free at thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend. Let's talk again Monday.